Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on station visits. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill say more personnel involved in the Secret Service Colombian prostitution scandal may be on their way out. U.S. consumer spending rose 0.8% in March, but existing home sales fell 2.6%. There's more wrangling on taxes, and the Environmental Protection Agency issued new air pollution rules for hydraulic fracturing. Joining me in the studio for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup are Ed Luce of the Financial Times, Laura Meckler of the Wall Street Journal, and Michael Scherer of Time Magazine. You can join us in talking about this week's news. Our number is 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email, drshow@wamu.org, or send us a tweet, or join us on Facebook. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Well, we have to begin again this morning with scandals, as we often begin here in Washington. The latest on the Secret Service scandal, 11 agents apparently involved in this prostitution scandal in Colombia. Now we learn that 10 military personnel have been involved, may have been involved as well. But the new development this morning, reported here on the front page of the Washington Post, is that one of the Secret Service supervisors who was ousted actually posted shots of himself on duty in dark suit, in a dark suit and sunglasses, including one that shows him behind Sarah Palin. And he says, along with this post, Ed Luce, "I was really checking her out, if you know what I mean."
Yeah.
This is a Secret Service agent assigned to protect Sarah Palin, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, the stupidity involved here is what strikes me the most. I'm a bit like, I don't forget whether it's Inspector or Captain Renault in Casablanca, in terms of not being that shocked about what Secret Service and military guys do in a place like Cartagena. But I am shocked a little bit more than by the low morals, by the low IQ that's been displayed here, to do this 2-3 days before the president turns up, and to then haggle and argue over price with these prostitutes involving Colombian police as an extraordinary display of stupidity. And this Facebook posting, I think, is just emblematic of that. That's what's shocking.
Do we know if Sarah Palin had any response, or anyone associated with Sarah Palin had any response to that?
Yes, I believe she did a Facebook response saying this is typical of, you know, typical of what you expect from government employees.
Well, government employees. But the truth is, Laura Meckler, the Secret Service has until now had a pretty solid reputation, right? I mean, this really taints the culture of what was a pretty prestigious and unblemished record.
Absolutely. And because of that, I think you hear some of the response from Capitol Hill as being a little bit muted. There's still support for Mark Sullivan, the director. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of statements about confidence in the agency and in its ability to carry out its mission. So you then have that up against these, you know, really horrifying allegations. And I think what a lot of people want to know is, you know, how widespread were these sort of, you know, I guess we could call them morally questionable at the least, you know, actions and attitudes. I mean, is this sort of a widespread view that it's obviously not all Secret Service agents? Is it many, or is it a substantial minority, or is it really just a few bad apples? I think that that's really an unanswered question right now.
Well, Michael Scherer, what of this point that Sarah Palin evidently made, that this indicates something about government employees generally? And of course, that would feed right into this kind of anti-government sentiment that is so rampant in the country.
There's a real tension right now in Washington between those who are trying to politicize this issue and those who are resisting politicizing this issue. You have here an apolitical organization, the U.S. Secret Service, that both Republicans and Democrats depend on, have great respect for, work closely with. And you have the great temptation in election year to turn this into a political football, make it about government employees. And at the same time, you have two other scandals going on. You have the scandal with the GSA spending obscene amounts of money on a convention in Vegas. And you have these photos the LA Times ran of soldiers mm-hmm. behaving badly and photographing themselves. And there's the real temptation here, I think, by some Republicans. You haven't seen all of them doing it. And a number of the senior Republicans have pointedly resisted doing it, including Mitt Romney, who came out with a statement very clearly in support of the Secret Service, to say, look, this is typical of Obama. He can't control his government workforce. This is typical of the government. We want to shrink the size of government. This is why Republicans' ideological goals are correct. In reality, there's not much to connect these two things. I mean, you need people to secure your top-level officials. If they were private employees, you could very well have these same problems. You need people, if we're fighting military operations, to be in the battlefield. You need people, to, like the GSA, to be doing the buying and selling for the government, whether they're whether we have a large government or a small government. So it's not really that issue, but there is that tension, right?
Well, Mark Sullivan, the director of the Secret Service, as you said, Laura, has gotten support. I mean, that's not a political appointment, is it? I mean, this is somebody that serves independently of which party's in power.
That's absolutely right. And there have been scandals in the past, and the Secret Service has weathered them. About a decade ago, there were a series of scandals about racial discrimination within the Secret Service. A lot of investigations. There was some discipline handed out, and then the agency moved on. Presumably, that'll happen again here. I think the real concern, though, is where it interacts security. I remember when we were in Moscow with the president a couple years ago now, being told by Secret Service that they had been approached in, you know, the line at Starbucks by people they presumed to be prostitutes. And there is a real security issue here. I mean, maybe not in Colombia, but in other governments, in other countries where you go, there are traps. There are attempts to lure U.S. government officials who have sensitive information or access into compromising situations. And it's the responsibility of the agency to be aware of those and to protect the president against them.
And even if it's not a trap, it's a risk. Because even if someone didn't start out thinking they were about to sleep with the Secret Service agent and they find out that that's the fact and they want to use that for some sort of blackmail or coercion, I mean, that potential is there. That's the one thing that everybody has cited as a security risk that was behind this.
Right. Ed Luce, it might be a little hard to spin this development, as supporting an anti-government message. But the General Services Administration story is something else entirely. I mean, you talk about something that epitomizes waste and abuse in federal government spending. It's this GSA scandal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that is pretty shocking. I mean, I do appreciate it when I see quotes from other federal employees saying, like, this is not typical of your federal employee conferences outside of Washington, that they might feel a little bit, associated unfairly with that. But, clown acts, mind readers, jacuzzis.
This conference, the expenses were close to $1 million.
Close to $1 million. And I think there's sort of pre-trips for the organizers. There were 8 pre-trips to Vegas. I mean, I think, again, I hate to bring this up again, but the IQ factor here is, you should know after AIG in early 2009 that what happens in Vegas gets out of Vegas everywhere pretty quickly.
Right.
And so this is an extraordinary sort of example of incompetence as well as abuse of taxpayer trust and money. And I think there is probably, Mike, mentioned that it's not yet taking off as a generalized critique of government, but I think there's the one that has the most juice has to be the GSA scandal. And Jeff Sessions, Daryl Issa, people like that are really hinting that they're wanting to ramp this up and keep it going.
The great irony here, of course, is that the General Services Administration's job is to responsibly spend money. That's the only thing they do.
It's the purchasing agency of the government.
And their only job, the people who work there, what they do every day is spend our taxpayer money in a responsible way. And to have them abusing the taxpayer trust like this is especially appalling.
Well, Laura, both in the case of the Secret Service scandal and in the case of the GSA scandal, there are or will be hearings scheduled. There were actually scheduled hearings this week on the GSA scandal, weren't there? And senators were just jumping all over each other trying
Absolutely. I think there were 4 hearings this last week, both the House and the Senate. And it was the outrage and condemnation was bipartisan, to be sure. I mean, Democrats were just as outraged as Republicans were on this. This is just, made to order for Congress to investigate. I mean, it's a big, juicy target. Nobody is going to push back on this at all. I mean, this guy, Jeff Neely, who was the one in charge of this conference, he showed up and he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. The people who did speak about it were, extraordinarily apologetic. So I think that what the question on this is going to be, again, how widespread is it? There was some talk at this hearing about not just this one conference, but that this particular region had a policy where you weren't allowed to have food at a meeting, but you could have food if it was an award ceremony. So they made up these fake awards. Well, now it's an award ceremony, a funniest guy in the office or something like that. So The question is, how widespread is it? Does it go beyond this? And that's something I think that's the focus of these hearings.
Well, it'll be a miracle, won't it, if these developments coming in an election cycle don't have some political implications, even though, as you all sort of agree, it doesn't seem like it's moving quickly in that direction. But this is also coming as we have debates over tax policy and new polls out, Ed's, showing that actually President Obama and Mitt Romney are in a pretty tight race.
Yeah, there's everything to play for. I mean, the economic numbers have been bouncing all around over the last few weeks, and you can pick and choose which direction you want from the menu of economic data. But if this continues to be new normal-ish, if this continues to look like an anemic recovery, then I would be very surprised if this isn't a very close presidential election. Look at the number of people in the New York Times CBS poll earlier this week who trust Obama to handle the economy well, way outnumbered by those who distrust him. That's a terrible number to be at 7 months before a general election for an incumbent.
And another thing that poll showed is that the economy is right at the top of voter concerns.
Yeah, it outweighs everything else combined. I mean, next week's employment, the week after next, employment numbers are going to be particularly interesting. And the signs are not for the initial jobless claims. The signs are that we might have a repeat of March, which is a disappointing month.
It was. Edward Luce is Washington Bureau Chief of the Financial Times. He's also the author of a new book, Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. This is the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Coming up, more of our discussion. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us. Welcome back to the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm with my guests, Edward Luce, the Washington Bureau Chief of the Financial Times, Laura Meckler, White House Correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, and also Michael Scherer, the White House Correspondent for Time Magazine. Laura, just before the break, we were talking about the New York Times CBS poll that showed two things. One, that Romney and Obama are very tight, and also that the economy is very close to the top of voter concerns. There's also a new poll out today in the Wall Street Journal, NBC Wall Street Journal poll that shows Obama quite substantially ahead, but it also shows him in a weak position as far as voters' confidence in his management of the economy, correct?
Mm-hmm. We asked voters which of the candidates do you think is better able to handle a variety of things, or who do you think has the advantage on a number of factors? And when asked, you know, who has the best ideas for the economy, Romney was ahead by about 6 points. The interesting thing was that there were a whole bunch of other measures where Obama was way ahead, such as, you know, is likable and personable, relates to problems like yours. You know, sort of understands all the sort of personal qualities of being able to relate to the lives of voters. Obama was ahead by, you know, in the range of 30 points. But so you can see that sort of that's also playing its way out in the race. But because the economy is such an important issue, that fairly small but real advantage that you see Mitt Romney have tells you why this is going to be a close race.
And Michael Scherer, meanwhile, not surprisingly, the Republicans and Democrats are both trying to play this concern to their advantage in Congress. We have the Republicans passing a new tax cut for small businesses with the intent of boosting job creation. Meanwhile, the Democrats are harping on Paul Ryan's budget, proposed budget, which would really hack social spending. And they also have come up, of course, they've tried to pass the Buffett rule to impose higher taxes on millionaires like Warren Buffett. What's this sort of what's going to be the outcome of all this jockeying back and forth to gain advantage of this economic concern?
Very little. We're in a year of that is going to make the past 2 or 3 years of congressional dysfunction look, you know, relatively pleasant. You know, the both parties are putting forward bills right now. The Buffett rule bill, which would basically put an alternative minimum tax on people who make over $1 million, raise about $46 billion to deal with the deficit, a relatively small amount, that is not going to pass the House. There's no way it's going to get through Congress. It's a political posturing by the White House to make their fairness narrative, this case that the president believes that all people need to chip in more and the Republicans are on the side of the rich. Something very similar is happening with House Republicans. They just passed the small business tax cut. Ironically, House Republicans have been harping on reducing deficits for years. That's their number one issue. Here they're passing something that is about $47 billion in added deficits. They're not paying for it. They're not talking about it. They don't mind. About half of the benefits will go to small businesses defined as companies with less than 500 employees who make more than $1 million a year. So it's a tax cut that's going largely to wealthy people. Those small businesses include sports teams, includes lobbying firms, include law firms. I mean, we're not just talking about mom and pop grocery stores.
But that category of firms does account for most of the jobs created in this country.
Yes, and most of the firms in this country. I mean, mm-hmm. the vast majority of firms in this country. But because it's a tax cut, most of the tax cut is going to the people who are making most of the income. So the very wealthy are going to take the largest chunk of this.
Well, speaking of tax cuts, Ed Luce, at the end of this year, we have something developing that the Heritage Foundation calls Tax Armageddon, or Taxageddon for short. A wide variety of tax cuts that are due to expire. We have this job creation bill that the Republicans have just proposed. But in addition to that, the Bush tax cuts are due to expire, $165 billion. The Social Security payroll tax cut due to expire, $124 billion. And others that total about $500 billion in tax cuts expiring at the end of this year, just as Congress is going into an election. What's going to happen?
Yeah, the mother of all lame duck sessions, as they're calling it. Well, it's a fiscal cliff, as I think anybody on any side of the spectrum would agree. If you have Congress do nothing, you go a considerable way towards solving the deficit, because the spending elements get rescinded and the tax cuts get reversed.
But then what a blow to the economy.
Then you go into recession.
$1 trillion.
Yeah. Then you go into recession too. And if so, of course, no, even though it's after the election, no turkeys, lame duck or otherwise, are going to vote for Thanksgiving. I can't believe that Congress will allow the economy to go back into recession. And not just recession, this is a 3.5% withdrawal of GDP. This would be a fairly pronounced recession, a self-inflicted goal. So I have to say, without any other evidence other than the self-preserving instincts of lawmakers, that it's hard to imagine them allowing this to happen.
Laura Meckler.
I think what happens in the lame duck session, all of this stuff expires, we should be clear, at the end of the year. Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think what happens will depend on what happens in the election in November. If President Obama is reelected and Republicans can maintain certainly control of the House and perhaps even the Senate, then I think there will be a lot of incentive to try to get some sort of an agreement that really deals with these issues. Although you never will lose betting against Congress pushing it off for another day. So they could always extend all this stuff for another 6 months or for another year. That would be sort of a typical approach. However, if President Obama loses, then I think that you're definitely going to see Republicans in no mood to compromise with him. And then there'll be a little bit of a game of chicken to see, are you willing to let this stuff expire? And if they do, then, you know, the first order of business when they get back in January is going to be to undo it. So it could be a very complicated situation because, you know, President Obama is not going to, I would bet, if he loses the reelection, I cannot see him signing an extension of the upper income Bush tax cuts, which he has vowed not to do. So I think what he probably would be willing to see it expire, but yet I don't think you would see Republicans willing to make a deal with him. So I think it all depends on what happens in the election. It's going to be a very, very complicated situation, both politically and economically, with so many things coming. One thing you didn't mention was the sequester is set to kick in, which is huge defense cuts and other cuts in spending.
Yeah. Michael Shero, another thing that these polls have shown is that Americans genuinely seem to care about the deficit and want to see coordinated action to reduce the deficit. Now, if we have $500 trillion in tax cuts expiring, and let's say, like in Laura's case, the Republicans actually feel that they have won the election, that's going to put them in a really difficult dilemma. Do you go with $500 trillion in tax cuts, or do you address the deficit issues that will be right there in front of you?
I think the deficit issue with Republicans historically has been one that they use in elections, that they use as a club against Democrats, and that when push comes to shove, if they have to choose between a tax cut and reducing the deficit, that they take the tax cut. And then they argue at that moment, like they did with a small business tax, that, oh, the economic growth that we're going to get from this tax cut will more than compensate for it. You know, what's lost in this debate, I think, is that there is a proper policy approach to this problem, that there needs to be tax reform. There's bipartisan agreement on this. There needs to be a lowering of rates across the board. There needs to be a simplifying of the tax code. There's broad public support for this. And what you see right now happening in Congress is both the Buffett rule and the small business tax code are complicating the tax code further. The parties are sort of running to their old playbook. And, you know, in an ideal world where you actually had a functional government, both parties would be meeting now, and there's some signs that that will begin to happen, to talk about how you could come out, regardless of the election's outcome, to something that is a sensible compromise in the middle here. That, you know, it could be weighted one way or the other, depending on the election's outcome. Although I'm not counting myself an optimist.
Well, there have been so many conversations, bipartisan conversations about how to deal with the deficit. To my mind, the issue is not that people don't know what to do or where a compromise might lie. I think everyone kind of knows more or less where it lies. It's a matter of, do people have the political will to make it happen?
What's the politics around this transportation funding extension bill that passed the House? I mean, Congress has been trying to pass transportation funding bills for a long time. Is there anything significant in the passage of this bill?
Well, you know, this bill has been extended, you know, many, many times. The House this week just passed its 10th extension, which was essentially a maneuver to get it into the House Senate Conference Committee. It's significant in a lot of ways. Number one, they attached a provision that would mandate approval of the Keystone Pipeline, which has been a political hot button for the last several months. Obama doesn't want to approve this right now because he feels like he doesn't have enough information yet to approve it. There's heavy pressure from the Republicans to go ahead and give it the okay. So you have that. Suddenly Keystone's been thrown into the middle of this transportation conversation and negotiation. At the same time, a lot of people view the transportation bill as a jobs bill because this is money for infrastructure spending and something that has traditionally been a bipartisan issue and is something that's been a part of the president's economic program, you know, certainly for a very long time, certainly since last September. So it's just another moment of Washington showing how it just does not know how to function over what were for many, many years, decades, routine sorts of legislation. The transportation bill used to be this something that members of Congress rushed to vote for because it was filled with goodies for their states. And things have just sort of turned around.
Well, we know what Ed Luce thinks of all these developments. His new book is called Time to Start Thinking: America in the Age of Dissent. You actually talk about American decline. And boy, the developments that we're talking about this morning certainly fit into that story, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, and to pick up what Laura was just saying about the transportation bill, you've got another game of chicken coming up of something that ought to be routine, ought to be core job of the Congress, which is the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank next month. And Eric Cantor, the Republican majority leader in the House, is threatening either to not raise its credit ceiling or only give it a one-year authorization, have this Damoclean sword hanging over it, as Congress likes to have over so many of its programs. And, you know, at a time when the rest of the world is really gearing up government support for exporters to difficult markets where the commercial markets don't operate, the commercial loan markets don't operate. This is a potential self-inflicted wound that is, I'm afraid, all too familiar with how Congress operates nowadays, has been operating for several years, and I'm fairly pessimistic as to whether that's going to change over the next few years either. It's self-inflicted damage we're talking about.
And we are seeing, it seems, every week new examples of the vitriolic sentiment that has erupted during this election cycle. I mean, last week we were talking about the Hillary Rosen and Ann Romney. This week it's Ted Nugent, the 70s rocker, who says that who's calling on opponents of Barack Obama to ride into battlefield next November and chop off the Democrats' heads. I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly, Laura. I mean, of course, you can't say that Ted Nugent is a Republican strategist, like was said about Hillary Rosen. But still, it's another embarrassment for a political party. You know, last week it was the Democrats' turn to be embarrassed by something one of their supporters said. This week it's Mitt Romney's turn to be embarrassed by something one of his supporters said.
Right. And he's somebody who endorsed Mitt Romney, who Mitt Romney said, as the Democrats will tell you over and over, it's been fun getting to know Ted Nugent. This is an example both of sort of the horrible coarsening of the political debate, where you have this kind of thing where Ted Nugent also said that if Barack Obama is reelected, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year, which prompted the Secret Service to actually interview him and clear him in the end, because clearly he wasn't actually making a threat, I think people thought. But they did talk to him and made sure.
It's good to see the Secret Service doing their job.
Secret Service, that's the kind of thing the Secret Service is supposed to be in the headlines for. But, you know, and then what you saw after that was the Democrats jumping all over this Ted Nugent remarks. It's using it in emails to, you know, the more outraged you are, the more you want people to know about it. So there, you know, they spread it in videos and emails to supporters.
Laura Meckler is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, Michael Scherer, where does this all seem to be going in the next few months? I mean, we've got so many polarizing developments, as I just said. In the latest, you know, the Trayvon Martin case, I don't know if you folks have seen the picture that ABC showed this morning. Apparently there was a cell phone. Here it is. A cell phone photo of George Zimmerman, the man who admits to having shot and killed Trayvon Martin, and he said it was in self-defense. Actually, a cell phone picture taken right after the incident shows that, in fact, the back of his head is bleeding.
Yeah, no, and in a lot of ways, that's not a surprise. The initial police report said he was bleeding from the back of his head. Really, the only reason this is news is because we had police footage of security cameras showing Zimmerman taken to the police station. It wasn't clearly evident that there was bleeding, and so some speculated that the police report may have exaggerated the bleeding. I think if you ask about the debate and where this is going, again, with Trayvon Martin, unfortunately, the basic currency of this conversation has been outrage. Mm-hmm. And the basic currency of the national conversation is outrage. You get outraged at Ted Nugent, you get outraged at Hillary Rosen, you get outraged that
George Zimmerman.
George Zimmerman. It's not to say there's not real need for outrage here, but the outrage becomes its own thing, and it more often than not ends up hurting the conversation rather than informing it or actually helping us figure out proper solutions to this. In the case of Zimmerman, we're not going to know until a jury sees this case, sees all the evidence, what really happened. The idea that the press, through leaks of information here, a cell phone photo here, or a videotape there, can figure out what happened in an incident where, as far as we know now, only two people were involved witnessed, and one of those people is dead, is not going to happen. And so you have these little bits that are going to come out. They're just going to fuel one side or the other.
Ed Luce, meanwhile, another big, important policy issue that has the environmental community really wrapped up is hydraulic fracturing, which is the technique of injecting water at very high pressure into shale oil and shale gas rock formations in order to extract that. And the EPA is now, environmentalists don't like this. The EPA has come out with some new rules on this.
Yeah, the environment, I've seen some environmental support for this. I think there's disappointment that the rules won't take effect till 2015. They feel that they can be put in place much quicker. I think there's disappointment that the methane emissions from hydraulic fracking aren't being directly regulated, because they're intensely contributing to global warming, far more so than carbon dioxide. And you've seen some disappointment from some of the industry groups. But what's interesting is that on both the environmental and the industry group side, there is division. It's not a unanimity on either side. So that does suggest they might have actually got it right.
Well, the Obama administration really was trying to thread a needle here between, as you say, the environmental concerns and also the industry concerns. And they did postpone the implementation of these rules until 2015, largely to give industry the time and the support to purchase the equipment they're going to need in order to come into compliance with these new regulations. So I think that was one aspect of this that industry groups it welcomed. On the other hand, the environmentalists are at least happy that the administration is looking at this issue. All right, we're going to be coming up in a break now. When we come back, we're going to go straight to the calls. This is the Friday News Domestic Roundup. You can join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, for 40 years working to improve health and health care. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. You've heard the international headlines. Now find out what they mean for you. Top journalists offer expert insight and analysis of the week's major news stories. We ask the questions you want answered. Join us for the Friday News Roundup, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm with my guests Edward Luce. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of the Financial Times newspaper and the author of a new book, Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. Also with me in the studio are Laura Meckler, the White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Scherer, White House correspondent for Time Magazine. And we're going to go to the phones now. You can join us, 1-800-433-8850. I'm going to start with Ralph, who's calling us from Battle Creek, Michigan. Good morning, Ralph. Thanks for the call.
Yes, hello. Good morning. You were talking about the budget, or let's say the tax issue, the Buffett rule, and what was it, Cantor's proposal to reduce taxes on business. I have to say I'm surprised that more people aren't talking about the fact that even the Ryan budget, which is supposedly the, I guess, the most aggressive at cutting government spending, is not going to balance the budget for two decades or more. And that's with all kinds of rosy assumptions. So I guess Paul Ryan is sort of the Tea Party favorite on the budget, and I'm reading here this the CNN column says that the U.S. Budget may never be balanced, or that it will be a question of managing the level of the debt. There's no talk, I guess, no serious talk about how serious the problem is, how we're going to have to deal with it. There's going to have to be sacrifices, I assume, from everyone, from tax increases to cuts, and no one's talking about a serious. The serious measures that have to be taken to even start to balance the budget.
So, Ralph, you're definitely one of those voters who's looking at either or both parties to get serious about reducing the deficit, and you're not happy about what you're seeing.
Right. Well, I'm trying to follow this, and mm-hmm. I guess I'm a supporter. I was a supporter of the Simpson-Bowles, which calls for tax increases and spending cuts and reform of the entitlements, et cetera. These are the big, big issues that should be front and center at the campaign, and they aren't. We're talking about little things. Okay.
Let's put this to the panel. Laura Meckler.
Well, people are talking about it, just people aren't doing anything about it. Like you said, there were Simpson-Bowles. There was this group that was dubbed the Gang of Six in the Senate last year. They were talking about a very serious proposal. The president and Speaker Boehner talked about a deficit reduction proposal. Neither side evidently was able to pull the trigger at the end, although they each ended up blaming one another. So now you have a situation where there's such a stalemate around these issues, where the decisions are so tough for each party, for Republicans raising taxes and for Democrats cutting entitlement spending, that it's just so toxic that neither presidential candidate is willing to take on their own orthodoxy inside their party on these issues in a political year. So sort of the most optimistic scenario is when we get to the lame duck session and all of these issues are before us as we move into 2013, that maybe there'll be a new opportunity. But you're right. The caller's right. No, neither of the candidates are talking about these issues.
And, in 2010, we saw the Republicans throw out Democrats. And if incumbents get defeated in this coming election as well, I mean, the one takeaway from this is that voters are really upset with their representatives, Michael.
Yeah, and it's a pattern that at least we're still seeing the possibility of repeating again, that voters get upset, that both parties appeal to their ideological bases, which drives them further away from compromise or rational discussion, which leads to another wave election, which then repeats the process once more. We're going to have to reach a point in which cooler heads prevail, and until the economy begins to improve and tempers decrease, it's probably not on the horizon.
Well, let's go to some of our cool-headed listeners. Rob, you're on the line from Springfield, Missouri. Good morning. Thanks for calling us.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on. I was going to discuss something that Sarah Palin had said about the perception of government spending, especially when the Senate doesn't bring up any budgetary bills to be passed by the Senate. And then there's this observation that groups like the GSA have no mind about budgetary control either. And it leads to public sentiment that these aren't the kind of elected officials that we want in office. And it may lead to a senatorial coup where the Democrats are pushed out, and then we'll have a Republican-led Senate and House, and very well have a Democratic president, which might not really be that bad of an idea, because then in the last 4 years of his presidency, he may feel that he needs to move more to the middle. There seems to be no middle ground right now that anybody wants to stand on, because they feel like it's just erodes away with the political sentiment.
Yeah. Well, Rob, thanks for the call. And you mentioned Sarah Palin's assessment of the significance of these scandals. You referred to the GSA scandal. Ed Luce, you mentioned what you remembered is her reaction to the Secret Service scandal. Our producer says that she can't find any specific remarks she made about government employees, although you were right, she did have a reaction to this particular incident of the Secret Service agency saying that he was checking her out. According to our producers, her reaction was as follows: "Well, check this out, buddy. You're fired." So, it has to be said.
Maybe I just sort of I expanded that in my head to her view of the whole government sector.
Well, I think that she probably relished the opportunity to react like that. Let's go now to Nelson, who's calling us from, where are you, Nelson? Clifton, Ohio. Good morning. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hello.
Good morning.
I would like to address the, pardon me while I gather the conversation has developed here. I experienced great frustration when Jimmy Carter got into office and left all the Republican appointees in place to his detriment. And the same with Clinton, many of the Republican appointees. And then, of course, the head of the Secret Service is a Republican appointee. And then they left these guys in office.
But not a political appointee. He may...
and also, I would like to say that that is also the fact, in the Gulf spill, where he left all the Republican screwballs at the head of that agency. And what happens is these Republicans, when they get away with this, they do what's called joyriding. So the Gulf spill was a joyride where they got really lax and did this and with the Secret Service, really lacks it, since it's a Democratic president, you know, didn't quite do our job there.
Yeah.
Also, for NPR, for 30 years, senior news analyst Daniel Shore, CIA agent who was in charge of...
Whoa. I'm not so sure about that. Let's just stick with your first comment, Nelson. I mean, Nelson is sort of implying that President Obama made a mistake by leaving Republicans in office. But we've seen screwballs in government appointed by both parties.
From both parties. And I think it's important to distinguish between different types of appointees. There are senior appointees in agencies that do have ideological roles where they set the direction of the agency. And then there are sort of administrative appointees. In the case of the Secret Service, there's not many ideological questions at play there. It's not like a Democrat runs it separately from a Republican. It may be one runs it more competently than the other. But in this case, the director of the Secret Service, his integrity has yet to be called into question by either party. It's really the rank and file that have the problem. And so it's not clear that there's a connection to his party affiliation at all.
Let's go now to Peter, who's on the line from Atlanta, Georgia. Good morning, Peter. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'll just make it quick. I retired from the Postal Service after 35 years, and the GSA and the Secret Service have got nothing on us. Fraud, waste, and abuse.
And you're speaking from the inside. Oh, my goodness.
A bigger bunch of nitwits and nincompoops you will never meet. At the higher levels.
The higher levels of the Postal Service, you're saying?
Oh, unbelievable. Go to a meeting and you'll sit there in awe.
This has always actually been a tension in government service, because the difference between a government job and a private sector job is the private sector job has certain pressures on it to make sure it's efficient because they want to make money for their investors or their owners. And a government job, you're kind of playing with other people's money. You're going to get paid.
No, they do more than play.
Right.
They just waste it and then blame other folks down the line.
No, and the trick here is that in Washington, no one has come up with a solution for this, because Republicans will say this is why you have to outsource more jobs to the private sector, but then they don't put in place the contracting structures to actually enforce the contracts and make sure the contractors don't abuse their power. And the Democrats will say, no, it's better we have public servants doing this, government employees, unionized employees doing this. And we see these sort of abuses. And there is no – these problems exist both with abuses on the private sector side and abuses on the public sector side. And as a city, we have not yet figured out how to really wrestle with it.
Well, it seems to me that with the budget, the fiscal issues that we're dealing with, there's going to be hard looks at government spending at all levels in all agencies, right, Ed?
Yeah, there is. Can I pick up something a caller said a couple of calls ago about the best divided government scenario being a Republican-controlled Senate and House and Obama in return to the White House.
Yeah.
I think it's exact opposite. I mean, if you were going to fantasize about a divided government scenario, I think there's far more scope to imagine a President Romney cooperating with a Democratic Capitol Hill, given his background in Massachusetts, given his famous flexibility, to put it mildly, than there is a Tea Party-dominated Republican Party to change its behavior from the last 2 years with how it's treated President Obama, or indeed for him to suddenly develop great skills at wrong-footing them. I don't see that as at all a plausible scenario for changing the way things are happening.
Well, Edward, I'm not sure very many people would find it plausible that you would actually get Democrats taking control of Congress while Romney is being elected president.
It's very, very unlikely. But if you're going to fantasize about divided government.
Okay, let's go now to Sue, who's on the line from Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, Sue. Thanks for calling us. Sue, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, all right. Well,
sorry about that. Thanks for taking my call. So this morning you opened up the show talking about the scandals at the Government Services Administration and the Secret Service, which is understandable because they're about sex and money and partying. But the Washington Post had a great expose this week on the FBI forensics lab screwing up evidence, and then the Department of Justice doing an investigation and finding that in about 250 cases, according to the Post, people were convicted and jailed based on this flawed forensic evidence. And they did nothing to notify the defense attorney, so people stayed in jail even after the DOJ understood that the evidence against them was weak, if not totally wrong.
And Sue, do you think there are some broader implications of that development? I mean, obviously, DNA evidence, for example, is very important in a lot of trials right now. Are you drawing any sort of lessons from that?
Well, I'm drawing lessons about the public discussion that I'm sure that, you know, I can't figure out how much it costs the American taxpayer to keep people in jail who were innocent. But I imagine it was more than that GSA party. And then also, it's a pattern at the Department of Justice. You've got the Ted Stevens case. You've got other cases that have broken in more recent years of Department of Justice prosecutors not turning over exculpatory evidence to the defense lawyers. And therefore, it is a much broader problem that the Department of Justice is.
Yep. All right. Thank you, Sue.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Well, Sue made her point. You guys don't cover the Department of Justice. None of us cover the Department of Justice. So we'll let Sue carry the ball on that one. Let's go to Mark, who's on the phone from Houston, Texas. Good morning, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think we can all agree that part of the problem with the deadlock government is that Congress is split. Let's assume that Obama is reelected. What does the panel think the chances are that the Democrats will retain the Senate and regain the House so that the government can get some things done?
Laura.
Well, the betting has been that for sure the Republicans are likely to keep control of the House because they have such a wide margin. They could lose several seats and still maintain their majority. Most people think that majority will shrink, but that the Republicans will indeed maintain control of the House. And the Senate, for a long time, there was the so-called smart money was on the fact that Republicans would take the Senate, too, because there are an enormous number of Democratic-held seats that are up for re-election this year and only a handful of Republicans, as it just worked out this year. However, in the last few weeks, there have been some sort of positive signs for the Democrats, and they're feeling a little bit better about their chances of maybe holding on to the majority, including, for instance, Senator Olympia Snowe, who was so disgusted by the way Washington works or doesn't work these days that she's retiring. And her seat, which obviously she's a Republican, a very moderate Republican, is now may potentially go to somebody who caucuses with the Democrats. So we've seen a little bit of change in the thinking about the Senate where that is maybe a little more up for grabs. But the Democrats have a hard road to get the majority back.
Laura Meckler is White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. I want to go now to a couple of emails that we've gotten, first of all, from Jill in Washington, D.C. Jill is wondering why the Republicans and Tea Partiers are so obsessed with cutting the deficit at this particular time. They've convinced everyone it's a huge problem. Seems to me they're only rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic with the economy in its current state. And, Michael, this was your point as well, that for all the professed concern about the deficit, we don't see evidence yet that either party has come up with practical solutions to really tackle it.
Well, and they just passed something out of the House, the same Tea Party crowd, that would add $47 billion to the deficit. So it's not a one-way street here with them. I think in a lot of our discussion today, one thing we've been leaving out is that the dysfunction in Washington right now is not just between Democrats and Republicans. Within the Republican House, there is a huge division between this sort of Tea Party freshman Republican class and the rest of the Republican body there, led by John Boehner. The transportation bill, the reason it's being punted to the conference committee is because Boehner can't bring his own people along with him. He's unable to do, again, the sort of things he wants. Recently, the White House had to put forward a veto threat because the freshman class there is trying to rearrange an agreement that both parties reached last year about what the spending levels would be for this year. That could, if this sort of brinksmanship continues, lead to a government shutdown in September, right before an election year. So it's not just Democrats fighting with Republicans. There's a lot of Republicans fighting with Republicans going on as well.
And this is going to give us grist for many Friday news roundups in the weeks and months ahead as we move forward in this election season. Michael Scherer is White House correspondent for Time Magazine. Our other guests this morning were Laura Meckler, White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and Edward Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and the author of a new book, Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. I'm Tom Gelton. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from